We're here at the Monument de la Renaissance Africaine in Dakar. It's the tallest statue in Africa. It's 171 feet, 52 meters, and speaks to high hopes for a continent so long held back by everything from geography to colonialism to the Soviet economic model enforced by Cuban troops. Now, when it was constructed, there were some objections from local imams that the Xi statue was a little too realistic. But if the message here is that African men are brave and handsome, African women are brave and beautiful, and African kids are brave and cute, I don't see a problem with that. But there are a couple of things about this statue that are a little bit concerning. And one of them is that it cost $27 million that people thought might possibly have been better spent alleviating poverty in the slums of Dakar. That one was not made better when President Abdoulaye Wade tried to divert some of the revenue from it to his own pocket, claiming intellectual property rights. Another matter of at least potential concern is that normally you like to have the event before you have the commemoration. They didn't paint Washington crossing the Delaware until after Washington had crossed the Delaware. And remember, bravery is not enough. Sometimes bravery takes the form of hunkering down and enduring, waiting for something better. Other times, bravery takes the form of creating a new and better world. Objections have also been raised simply on the grounds of taste, which does bring me to the question of whether there might be better ways to assert a rebirth of African authenticity than to have a North Korean outfit use a Soviet artistic style inspired by a German ideology. But the big problem that I want to address here, which is connected to that one, is the problem that the statue shows these Africans escaping from things that are trying to hold them back. And unfortunately, one of those now is a new breeding kind of imperialism in which do-gooders in Western countries are working very hard to deny Africans the ability to develop the energy resources that will make a true, indigenous, lasting, and meaningful renaissance possible on this continent. And we're here to tell you about that. We've come to the Guéjoué district of Dakar to talk about poverty in Senegal, in Africa, and in too much of the world. Or, more exactly, to look at it. Because of course, we did our homework before we got on the aeroplane, and I can tell you that Senegal has a GDP per capita nominal of somewhere around $1,800 US, and that the purchasing power parity number is somewhere around $4,000. And I can even tell you that someone did a Gini coefficient and said that it has moderate inequality. Really? What's the Gini coefficient of this? It's all part of this Western obsession with numbers. Galileo said that mathematics is the language in which the universe is written. And so we like to measure things in such a way that we can then run them through an equation and produce fancy results. And Milton Friedman, who I admire greatly, had this mantra of, if it matters, measure it. To which my retort was, yeah, and if it measures, matter it. But how much faith do you really have in GDP statistics in Senegal? How much of the activity here is off the books?
It didn't take long in Dakar, in Saint-Louis, and in other urban areas for us to learn to recognize which firms were almost certainly official, with big glass storefronts, fancy showrooms, and electric signs, and which were almost certainly not, with shabby little booths and handwritten publicity. And it didn't take long for us to recognize that there were far more of the latter.
They're not registered with Corporation Senegal. They don't file an annual return. They may well not pay taxes. On the other hand, they may well have to pay bribes just to be left alone to get on with their lives. And none of that gets captured in the official statistics. But what you can see here is that there are a lot of things in the way of these people making their lives better. My first question is, how did you come to set up a shop here?
Oh, I set up a shop here because a mayor of a town, his name is Magat, well, as well, same name, everything. And so he's been reading about me in the paper.
We decided to be in a village. Everybody who goes back home, the few who go back home to build a company, they all go cluster themselves into the capital city. I know why they're doing that. It's because everything is in the capital city. All these government agencies that you're going to have to deal with are in the capital city. And because of that, everybody, even better employees, better everybody, is going to be in the capital city. Meanwhile, our countryside is being emptied of its most, you know, strong people. They say if you have anything in your mind, you're in the capital city. If you have any skills, you're in the capital city. So we're left with older people and kids for the most part, and women that they deemed to be not very well educated. So I said, we have to do something about this.
So you then had a successful career in North America before you came back here. When I refer to you as an entrepreneur and an activist, I'm really describing one career, not two, because you're trying to make it happen here by running a business and by trying to improve the conditions under which businesses operate here. And one of the problems, I understand, it's just very hard to get a business established, to get through the paperwork and to get the licensing.
When you said that I'm an activist, I call myself a prosperity activist for Africa. And so my whole thing is about prosperity. And there too, one of the dots that I got to connect through my own lived experience, but it's backed by empirical evidence, is the fact that poverty is solved by prosperity, not poverty alleviation. The goal should not just be to be a little bit less poor. That's nonsense. The prosperity is built by entrepreneurs, and entrepreneurs need an enabling business environment, as well as, again, access to affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources.
And what is it that you make here?
We create skincare products. Right now, we have a line of lip balms, body balms, and we have a line soon of skincare products coming up, you know, specifically for the face, and focused on nighttime, the wisdom of the night, because the best beauty ingredient is sleep.
So I was reading this very strange piece in The Economist, and they were all enthused about the African diaspora, because they said more and more of the working age people in the world are African, and a lot of them are going to come to other countries to work, because in Africa, 15 million people roughly enter the workforce each year, but there are only 3 million formal jobs. And I thought this was actually a terribly sad statement, only 3 million formal jobs. What a nightmare for all these young people looking to build a career, get some equity, support a family, and they're stuck in the informal sector where none of that happens.
It tells you everything you need to know. Bottom line is, the world has given up on Africa ever getting its act together or providing to its people what the people need. In this case, you know, jobs and prosperity.
And then they notice Africa and they say, hey, I know what we should do. We should make them use solar power. We shouldn't let them use all that nasty planet warming natural gas and so on. And so, in fact, there's a lot of international money and attention and, in some sense, idealism directed to stopping Africa from doing the other critical thing, which is getting reliable energy.
They come with the same mindset of being usually anti-capitalist, anti-business. Can't you be just like Scandinavia? Well, Scandinavia, all of Scandinavia is more capitalist than almost all African nations. Does Bernie Sanders know that? I don't think so. Temperatures are rising. This is unsustainable. If we continue this way, this planet is gonna go boom, right? That's what they've been telling us. Al Gore has been telling us, and I would like to talk to him right now, by the way, because all of his predictions have turned to be wrong. And meanwhile, the guy keeps traveling around in private jets, you know, just whatever, like it was, Earth is never gonna end. All of those people who have co-opted the concept of caring about Africa and Africans, what you're trying to push for, she's net zero, you know, truly by tomorrow. And insofar as you're telling me, because Earth is at risk a few years down the line, unless we stop everything now, meaning Africans absolutely cannot touch fossil fuels, then you're telling me it is okay for you, for people to continue dying. This is people who are energy poor. They're doing this because they're energy poor. And so you're telling me that it's okay to keep those that many people dying and perhaps the rest of Africa never ever develop. That's what you're saying. So if that's what you're saying, I need to hear it. And if you're saying it, you need to go on record for that. Every time we can do better for the environment, absolutely, I'm there, I'm the first one. But at the same time, we have humans that we need to keep alive.
Well, and especially, how about the rich countries go first? Because they've got some room, and let the poor countries get rich, and then they can worry about it.
That's right.
And of course, one last piece of this puzzle that's odd is that when you talk about this entrepreneurship and economic freedom, people are liable to tell you, yeah, but that's not authentically African. Like, you all are socialists, right? Yeah. So therefore, don't adopt a foreign tradition. Yeah. And before I let you talk, the irony, of course, that so much of Africa adopted the Soviet model as though that were somehow indigenous, and it was a disaster. But you don't believe that Africans are inherently socialist, do you?
I don't believe that. And the reason why I don't believe that is because it's not. It's not true. You've come around here. You've seen... Are you seeing socialism around you? You see people at the market. Everybody's selling you something. It's capitalism everywhere you turn around here. Everywhere. Everybody is hustling. Africans are not... We're not socialists by nature. Here, too, we have great evidence. When you go back to pre-colonial times, it is very well documented that Africans... We've been traders forever. We have had some very sophisticated trade routes, very sophisticated markets, very sophisticated ways of creating even insurance at site. Property rights has been part of our MO for part of our governance system for a long, long time. And so this idea that Africans are socialists is complete rubbish, complete nonsense. Now I know that what it is that people confuse it with Ubuntu. Ubuntu is I am because we are, right? That is what makes so many Africans think that we're socialists. That's not to be socialist. Just like, so here at the African, at the community level, we're very much about taking care of each other. You know, very communal people, we take care of each other from that standpoint. But the way we make our money is very much, you know, free market way, free enterprise way. And then the way we want to redistribute it among ourselves, it's all voluntary, first of all, and it's just the way we, our way of life. Though that's very different from saying that you're using a socialist economic system. That's purely a colonial import. Socialism, the socialism mindset is a colonial import.
And of course, you're walking the walk in this because you have a factory. You are employing people. You are giving them an opportunity to better themselves. You're giving them dignity. You're giving them purpose. That's Ubuntu in action in the best possible way.
We would like to hope so. And for me, I don't like to say that I give them jobs or anything. I'm not giving anybody anything. The market, there is a market that allows us to see, oh, there's a market opportunity here to create a skincare company because there's a market for these products, right? And I have access to that market. So let us build a company around it. And of course, if you build a company for which end products for which there is a market, you're going to need the people to work and make these products and the people who make this company go round. And those businesses need people. And those, each person needed is a job, and each job provides an income. And with that, people are able to stand on their own 2 feet. That ability to stand on their 2 feet and be productive members of society, then provide them. It's that work of theirs that provides them with a sense of dignity. So it's not so much me giving anybody anything. I saw an opportunity in the market. I went for it, dropped the business. That business needed people, you need jobs. Jobs created, income there, people use it to run their lives. It's really not rocket science. It's really not that hard. But what makes it hard in our country is we had this artificial bondage that are there, again, in the bad business environment, as well as the poor, you know, energy situation that we're in.
All right. Well, thank you very much, because Africa needs 3 things. It needs economic freedom, more energy, and more people like you. And here we come to one of the paradoxes of development, because it seems it's not just very hard to know what you should do, it's apparently very hard to know what you shouldn't do. When you look at scenes like this, a lot of people say, what we need is more foreign aid. But probably, in fact, what we need is less foreign aid, for a number of reasons. The first of these is that self-government requires that the state be dependent upon the consent of the people for its revenue so that it can operate. And if money's pouring in from abroad, that disconnects the state from the people and their priorities. In the narrow sense of responsible government, remember what happened in the Anglosphere is that the state became dependent on the people and their representatives to raise tax money.
There's an old jibe that foreign aid transfers money from poor people in rich countries to rich people in poor countries, which I've seen variously attributed, including to Lord Peter Bauer. And this problem is worse than it seems, because to the extent that third world governments that pursue exotic first world or second world projects are decoupled from the need to get revenue from the domestic tax base, they're freed both from direct political accountability and from the indirect accountability that comes from only getting enough revenue to do what you want from a flourishing economy if the people in your nation are prospering by doing what they want.
There's a line from the novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. I mean, he was one of these guys that we read when I was in my 20s and we felt very clever because we didn't understand any of it. But it turns out, I discovered when he passed away recently, that Vargas Llosa had been an admirer of Fidel Castro, but he'd become a free marketeer.
And he had this line about the romantic fallacy of many rich Westerners, which was to deal with his native Latin America, quote, as with a plebeian mistress with whom all those secret fantasies and frightful excesses, prudently repressed in their relations with their wives, their native countries, can be given free rein, end quote.
Now, as a matter of fact, they've gotten less restrained about that. A lot of strange things are happening in the first world. As we just saw, there was a huge blackout in Spain, so the same kind of fad policies on energy that they're urging on Senegal, they're also adopting at Colombia. You'd think they'd be learning a lesson. But the critical point here is that what these people need, as Charles Murray realized when he was a foreign aid worker, what these people need more than anything else is control of their own lives so that they can make them better. And one of the critical functions of foreign aid, deliberately or otherwise, is to prevent them from getting that control.
It's extraordinary what a vast, interlocking, and wealthy web of public, parastatal, and private development agencies exist in the world. One 2021 effort to survey what development leaders really want addressed, and climate change was not near the top, listed dozens of them, from the Asian Development Bank to ASEAN, to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Caribbean Development Bank, the China International Development Cooperation Agency, the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, yes, it's still around, the European Union, the Food and Agriculture Organization, the International Finance Corporation and the International Monetary Fund, and the OECD, the United Nations Development Programme, UNESCO, and the World Bank. Arguably, these people don't have much to show for 8 decades of do-gooding, but is there a single one of them today that's not obsessed with climate change? Or statism? And is there a single one that's really driven by the needs and wants of those on the ground? In the Wall Street Journal in December 2024, Bjorn Lomborg underlined the size and the shiftiness of their commitment. Quote, members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development currently spend $223.7 billion a year trying to do good in poor countries through bilateral and multilateral aid and development spending. It is politically much easier for politicians intent on green spending to shift this money to climate purposes than try to get voters to go along with fresh outlays. Rich nations have diverted much of this funding to climate change initiatives. OECD members spent one-third of their direct development aid on climate in fiscal 2021-22, the most recent year for which data are available. Development banks have twisted their purpose even further. The World Bank last year sent 44% of its lending to climate causes, the African Development Bank 55%, and the European Investment Bank 60%, end quote. And there's more. Quote, in 2021, the G7 ended public funding for all fossil fuels. The idea was to promote use of renewable energy so as to help slow climate change. Their decision gave G7 leaders a feel-good moment, but cutting public funding for energy projects only hurts the world's poorest countries, mainly in Africa, end quote. Despite which, the usual suspects are all in. The New York Times warned in February 2025 that, quote, the World Bank pivoted to climate. That now may be a problem, end quote. Oh yes? Why might that now be a problem? Green imperialism? That business with the proletarian mistress? Heck no, it's because of Donald Trump. Boo, down with Trump. Quote, as the Trump administration imposes deep cuts on foreign aid and renewable energy programs, the World Bank, one of the most important financiers of energy projects in developing countries, is facing doubts over whether its biggest shareholder, the United States, will stay on board, end quote. It didn't seem to think that it should be developing such doubts. Instead, Times columnists freaked out at the prospect of cuts to USAID, as if international aid had a sparkling record generally, and that outfit particularly had a sparkling record, instead of being a notorious mess. Now, to be fair, one of the Times' news stories acknowledged that Trump's energy secretary, Chris Wright, resonated strongly with African leaders when he told them to develop all sorts of power. And the piece even quoted him that this government has no desire to tell you what you should do with your energy system. It's a paternalistic post-colonial attitude that I just can't stand, end quote. And, the piece went on to concede, quote, Mr. Wright's appearance on Friday was met with roaring approval. His remarks were in line with what many African energy developers have been urging for years. They say the persistence of energy poverty is a blight on the continent's development, and Western skittishness to invest in energy projects, whether because of concerns over governance or greenhouse gas emissions, is akin to keeping Africa down, end quote. But that piece is an outlier. Another in the New York Times Climate Forward in January 2025 was strangely frank about the paper's attitude. Quote, this week, top officials from dozens of African countries convened with major international lenders to commit to the biggest rollout of renewable energy in the continent's history. The $35 billion in loans from the World Bank, African Development Bank, and other financial institutions at below-market interest rates are aimed at getting electricity to half of the 600 million Africans without it. About half the money will go toward village-level solar grids. It wasn't just a hopeful moment for people who've been deprived of the most foundational facet of modern life. It's a moment that could have enormous climate implications. And yet, the words climate change were barely uttered at the two-day summit in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. One moment encapsulated the dynamic. Akinwumi Adesina, head of the African Development Bank, was on stage on Monday speaking to the assembled leaders. He pointed into the crowd, picking out Mukhtar Babayev, the Azerbaijani official who was president of last year's United Nations Climate Summit, known as COP. You all talk about energy transition, he said animatedly. Our women are transitioning life, right out of life. Because of the lack of power, they are cooking with charcoal inside their houses, and they are dying, end quote.
So here's a small but telling example. The blackout problem at Dakar has actually gotten a lot less serious recently. I was talking to somebody who grew up here and they said when they were a kid, power would go off all the time. You know, it'd be gone for 12 hours and then, yes, it's back. Oh, it's gone again. But now that's unusual, maybe once a year. And one of the reasons why is that ship out there. That's been out there for 3 years supplying LNG to the city, which helps to keep the lights on. And you know, Western alarmists hate natural gas. They say, oh, it's 25 times worse than CO2 or it's 80 times worse. They don't even want it used to replace coal. They're purists and must have solar panels. So, do you really want to tow that ship out of Dakar Harbor and tell these kids here on the beach that they're going to grow up in the dark without the fridge working and maybe having the power go off at the hospital in the middle of a procedure? That's the kind of misplaced priority, a failure to understand the trade-offs that makes Western environmental policy so dangerous to people in four countries.
Much of the world is poor in ways Westerners cannot imagine. Even the homeless or down and out in our cities are a short ride in a modern ambulance away from a fully equipped hospital. In many places, especially in Africa, there's no proper road, there's no drinking water, and crucially, there's no light switch. And it's the last, that energy poverty, that matters most. With energy, you can move mountains. Without it, you carry things on your head. And we're in Senegal partly through serendipity, having friends who can help us tell the story here, and partly because Africa is the epicenter of this problem, and Senegal exemplifies the disaster, the hopes, and the pitfalls. Again, we did our homework before getting on the plane, including that with a per capita electricity consumption of just 0.47 megawatt hours, Senegal is in the bottom quarter of all countries and territories, 171st in the world out of 212 jurisdictions, but sadly typical of much of Africa, being slightly below Angola and Mozambique, and slightly above Mauritania and Lesotho. The Canadian figure is 30 times as high. And even Vietnam, which is the median average and a poor and troubled communist nation, has nearly six times the electricity consumption of Senegal. Now that's just electricity. But for overall energy consumption per capita, bearing in mind that some countries are more electricity heavy than others, and not all statistics are reliable, Senegal has an almost identical rank, 37th from the bottom, between Zimbabwe and Nigeria above and Benin below, and about 1/40th of Canada's. And of course, in misdeveloped countries, the urban-rural divide is far wider than in places like Canada, where even remote cabins have electricity. It's worth noting that in Egypt, the notorious informal City of the Dead in Al-Arafah Cemetery has illegal power hookups to the vaults in which three generations have somehow lived without any legal title to their property. So there's a lot of harsh poverty in the third world of different kinds. But some of the worst of it is where there's no power. In rich countries, where we take electricity so much for granted that we may well not even notice the dense web of power lines overhead, there can be a certain romance in getting away from it all. As I said in my 2017 documentary, The Environment, A True Story, I grew up in a remote cottage on Georgian Bay, miles from the nearest road, without electricity, a telephone, mercifully, or an indoor toilet. And it was paradise. But of course, it was the best of both worlds. Our propane lights and fridge, yes, you lit it with a match when you got there, were driven by big steel tanks of industrially produced gas. And if you got sick or were injured, a fast boat with a modern gas engine rushed you to a hospital where the lights did not go off. In much of Africa, they never go on. Just how bad is it? Well, we're going to show you some of the nitty-gritty in this film. But while precise numbers differ, and some of the agencies make a fuss about sustainability at the expense of switch-on-ability, the general consensus is that around 1 billion people worldwide have no electricity at all. Over half of them in sub-Saharan Africa, where over half the people have no such access. And another maybe 350 million in Asia. But around the world, perhaps another 1 billion people have unreliable, intermittent access, and among other things, they cook with wood, charcoal, crop stubble, and animal dung, with devastating health consequences. As Aristotle said, we shouldn't ask for more precision in any subject than it can rationally provide. And for obvious reasons, it's extremely hard to count people who don't have access to electricity or who are cooking with waste, from rural Africa to that Cairo cemetery. You know, it's hard to get the numbers right even when governments aren't trying to fudge them, either bumping them up to exaggerate their success or bumping them down to emphasize their needs. But one ingenious effort to assess the problem by the United Nations Development Program, using satellite photos to see how much the world was essentially dark at night, doesn't just give some confidence in their overall conclusion. It also drives home the shocking contrast between people like me who can sit at our keyboards accessing their remarkable graphics via the internet and downloading them into a Word file, and those for whom a keyboard, if they had one, would just be a really lousy tray. But of course, there's another way to grasp this poverty than watching it from space via satellites. It's to see it from ground level as a matter of actual people, though that one, of course, has limits too, including our inability to convey the stench and the sting of the smoke. While in Dakar, where of course they have electric trains and electric buses because all the cool kids do, we spoke to people about the state of the energy grid, and it was immediately obvious how important it was to have backup because of how bad it is if the power goes off.
Je m'appelle Pierre Amara da Silva. C'est ça, ingénieur électromécanique, donc actuellement au niveau de la CTR. On pourrait dire que c'est interurbain, mais en fait, ça relie le centre, Dakar, à la zone de Diamniadio pour l'instant, donc un peu sur la périphérie de la ville. Et va aller dans un deuxième temps vers l'aéroport, à IBD. Donc le train, il utilise bien sûr l'électricité de la Senelec, qui est fournie par la société sénégalaise d'électricité, mais il a également une deuxième partie qui est diesel, donc il utilise le gasoil. Chaque train a à son niveau un générateur qui marche au gasoil. Bon, globalement à Dakar, c'est vrai que l'électricité est beaucoup mieux partagée, beaucoup mieux distribuée depuis ces dernières années. Maintenant, quand on sort de Dakar, il y a certaines villes comme Thiès où ça se passe très bien, ils ont l'électricité couramment, mais dès qu'on commence à s'éloigner, donc dans les zones un peu reculées du pays, là l'électricité est moins présente. On peut utiliser l'énergie solaire. On a du vent, on peut utiliser l'énergie éolienne. Mais on ne peut pas utiliser que ça. On ne peut pas se baser uniquement sur ça et laisser les hydrocarbures qui sont là, qu'on peut utiliser et que, en fait, à travers l'histoire, beaucoup de pays ont utilisé pour se développer, avant de pouvoir passer à de dernières zones.
Bon. Je suis à Rebus, je suis à Rebus, mais je suis à la place. Je suis à la cabane, je suis à la tante. Découpé, de temps en temps, découpé. motax ñi wax sax di wax sénélek coupé rek ba ak dund bu cher bi dund bi dafa cher paré en plus soxla nañ énergie tamit parce que bo xolé tay nit ñi mu ngi dund sans énergie ah mu doon wax ni ñun soxla luñu gëna soxla fi moy énergie waaw à part bu féké ni gaay mu nañ wañi dund bu cher bi su dul lolu ñun énergie lañ soxla parce que bo xolé ñun am nañ problème énergie parce que fi ni même suñu kër yi chaque essence ñi ngi nekk am nañ courant na mais limi coupé dafa bëri parce que bo xolé sénélec bi limi alimenter bëri wu
Bonjour, c'est Myriam Sagna, docteur en médecine, médecin généraliste. J'ai commencé la médecine ici en 2007, la formation médicale. Je viens de France et je suis arrivée à Dakar il y a presque 2 ans maintenant. Les groupes et les projets. Même s'il y a une pure d'électricité dans la ville et dans les quartiers, en 4 pouces pas, ça repart. Parce qu'on a forcément des patients qui doivent tout le temps être, disons, raccordés à l'électricité, que ce soit en réanimation ou en néonat. Félicitations. Donc ça reste ici à la sortie en tout cas de la région de Dakar, c'est à 12h l'île de Dakar. Je ne suis pas allée plus loin, mais j'ai pas mal de valiens. Pour frères, consoeurs qui sont partis très à l'île de l'île, comme par exemple. Eux n'ont pas eu de problème en rapport à l'électricité, de ce que je sais, mais c'était qui sans problème de de matériel médical, il est médical. On a seulement en tête que c'est légal dans les pays pauvres. Les gens pauvres vont être mec et les gens riches vont être pure. En fait, c'est vraiment en train de s'inverser. En déchet, le patient va vider avec ce qu'on appelle un pied diabétique, c'est-à-dire un pied qui est nécrosé, qui va falloir et qui va se que. Ce n'est pas si long parce que le patient n'avait pas les moyens, mais il n'y avait pas de hockey sur le terrain. Le patient devait faire 2 heures de route en charrette plus au rang de centre de santé.
In rural areas, the power is less reliable. And it's not just a question of whether the lights are out at the health clinic. It's the way people in the hinterland live and the kinds of medical problems that they bring to the local doctor in consequence.
Moi, je m'appelle Cheikh Diouf. Je suis docteur en médecine. Ici à Mérée depuis 2021. Les défis sont énormes. Hein. Déjà ici à Ngaï, avant mon arrivée, il n'y avait pas de clinique, il n'y avait pas de privé. Ce qui m'a poussé à venir ici, c'est que lorsque je travaillais à l'hôpital des gens, il y avait beaucoup de monde, beaucoup de Mérewois, des gens qui habitent Mérée, qui venaient jusqu'à l'hôpital pour se faire soigner, pour faire des consultations simples. Et je me suis dit, ah, pourquoi pas ne pas aller en Ngaï, au lieu qu'ils viennent à l'hôpital pour des centaines de mètres, de kilomètres pour venir là-bas. Je me suis dit, pourquoi ne pas venir ici, tant de essayer d'aider la population. C'est vrai que l'énergie ici en Afrique, c'est toujours un défi et c'est pas toujours évident. Parfois, il y a des coupures. Donc, en tant qu'agent de santé, nous devons avoir l'électricité, dont le courant, 24 heures sur 24. Parce qu'on travaille sur des personnes, on a un laboratoire à faire faire tourner qui a besoin de l'énergie et tout. Par exemple, si on prend l'exemple à Dakar et à Thiès, ils ont vraiment leurs labos sont beau équipés. Ils ont leur scanner, leur IRL, leur radiographie. Et par contre ici, en fait, les problèmes que nous rencontrons par rapport à la base, c'est plus à l'exploration complémentaire qui couvre vraiment diagnostiquer les pathologies. Pas.
And another thing, we're here in the extreme north of Senegal at the barrage de Diama, the Diama Dam. On the other side is Mauritania. And by the way, when I was a kid, I always thought it was a cruel geographer's prank that Africa would have Mauritius and Mauritania and they'd be separated by an entire continent. But I digress. The point is, they've built this dam here for a number of purposes. One of them is to assist with irrigation, and another related one is to stop the salt water from coming up the Senegal River. And they have made some efforts to exploit the river as a hydroelectric resource as well. The problem is, it's just not that fast flowing and suitable. So when you're talking about alternative energy, it's important to bear in mind that not everybody has Niagara Falls. They're doing what they can here, and it seems very small-minded to object
that it's not exactly what we might have done if it had been a different continent under different circumstances. Of course, to get a proper look at the issue, we had to get into rural Senegal. In this case, a village close enough to see the power lines and with the zealots' cherished solar, which shuts off when the sun goes down, though our car could barely make it up the sand road to a place whose location few people seem to know, though when we got there, our host Magat Wade showed us the kind of conditions that she grew up with here in Senegal.
I was born in Senegal, the west coast of Africa, and when I was around age two is when my parents made the decision that many African parents before them have made, and so many more to this day keep making, which is, you know, think of your child and realize that the best thing you can do for them is to actually leave them behind for a while you go away to greener pastures. I remember when I first arrived in Germany and back home, when my grandma says, "Magat, it's time for you to take your shower," I know I've got a good 45 minutes to an hour to go play some more. I knew she would have to get a stove of coal going. Then she puts a pot of water on it, waits for it to boil.
I mean, seriously?
Yeah.
And you see how hot it is?
Mix it with some cold water so that it doesn't burn me.
Okay, so you see, no more water. It's no more. So you see how the water, how little it is? Because it's getting to the point where it's going to be closed. The water is going to close soon. So you see, there's little water. So you have to try to do as much as you can because after a while, it's going to be shut down. At least, you know, at least they have a this faucet because none of the homes has running water. So, but they have this communal faucet here to use.
And then eventually somebody stronger than her would drag it to the shower area.
So this is a shower area. So you could come and see the shower. This is basically the shower. So I would get in here, here, right? And then I would close this door to hold it. Yeah. I would open. Privacy. Got it? Right? And now I'm showering. What I would do to have a shower when I was a kid. Yeah, this is it. And then this side here usually would be where you go to the bathroom.
And so here my mom says, "I got time for your shower." I'm like, where's a bucket of warm water? I'm not getting butt naked in this weather. It was cold. It was winter. And she's like, "Oh, come on, you silly. Just jump in the shower." And I go in there and I turn these knobs and the water's coming down. I figure that even it seems like you can play with the pressure, you can play with the temperature. I didn't even know what running water was. For me, you know, you don't have water in your home. It's just like you go to the faucet, the big faucet, the communal faucet. It was one that everybody could use and it would open within certain hours. So all the people, the women especially, they would be going. They know that they should go and they go with these big buckets and you fill out as many as you can, bring them back, cover them. And it was the same thing about, you know, the so many different types of apples, and in the paved roads, the question of how come they have this and we don't became how come some countries like mine are poor while others are rich. And so that question never left me. You see the suffering, you see everything we're missing out on, and you're just like, no, we gotta have to find a way to bridge this gap. On one end, it's freedom, especially economic freedom. So this freedom to enterprise. And on the other end is access to affordable, reliable, abundant energy. Period. That's it. That's it. In the end, it's that simple.
Wow.
She said, lini fi dama koy tek fele jënd gas defar yépp tok taxou di dom saxar si dafa metti saxane bi yanu mat di ñu ba iné ci
wa
ban di gam ak midi gudde mu tan awu ay sonu pot ay pot ak lune rek daw ci lendeum ci étoile ni demé étoile bu gudde do ñi may gën def sonu am ko yu mel ay jitt non jitt yu ndaw yi
lool dafa danger
ay jitt waaw yoy ñuy sonu rek
ci cette discours ça
wéri ñuy sonu gudde
di xamna lolu mais est-ce que mais ben du roi ya te ba
xam nga day ray mo
wa
bir ah ci bir ni
lo len def bu boba
dem yobbu ci dekk yu sori
charat bi mo len yobbu
wu saretal yu yobbu am ñu naral yu yobbu
ene mom dem nga école
ci
never went to school
can she read him right
nena est-ce que mo nga lire ak
dara dara
wa
sama bu ñu mag exam fa jang fa am ba ñu am liggey ñu dem tukki
ah tukki fan mama
ah tukki xana kay liggey ñew indi fi ndax ñun fon nan
ma neene do la nam
ma leen da li nam mom waye na xolal li fi rek dañuy dox kay
deug da ngay wax
dañuy dox dañuy dox
pou dem
dox buñ xeyé dox waaj ñew dox ak dem
buma yew
quoi
noddu
noddu
moma ye
voilà
bëpp ya so ma dégg noddu ma yew dem japp julli
20 gos
je reste léré par quoi sama xey buma ndeki ma xey ma jël sama gupp ma dem ki tool damay sangu bu pare ci àll bi mat
i sang wood
fam benay jël
fama fiyal
dama mu ñëw taal dek si taal bi fab noppale bi teg ci fab kin bi teg ci mu bax ñi jël café gi toog xem leen di wutali mat indi tegal yee jigéen ñi jël ñoom togge comme bi ngeen toggee léegi man maa ko wut ci àll
bi
indil jigéen ñi
man
maay jëli mat ci àll bi indil leen ñoom ñi jël dem ñoom yóbbi ci taal bi taal toog yekk teg nar dee café gér noonu lañ koy xelte ndax fii gaas jàpp ndiw courant amu
si di pàqe mat
pàq mat na mat ñaari waxtu tool bi ñun danay bay nawet bi bu nawet bi jeexee daanaka noor bi du ñu am liggéey nawet la nay bay ñetti weer yi muy taw dugub
ok
gerte
peanut
ñebbe
peas
lii lay bay dugub gerte ñebbe basi tiñ lii lay bayee maanaam machine ji dafa am machine bay am mais ñun machine bay bi sax machine ji bis léeg-léeg dañuy të da ngay dem ci tëgg yi wut lu benn machine machine boobu ngay jiye bu ma ci jiye jox keemu ji kay di noonu lañ ci def soo paree nag machine bay bi nga jël toog bay soo paree nag nga yor sa loxo ak sa gub di defaraat toog ñu noonu lañ koy liggéey waaw machine mu xam nga l'école man arab laa jàng
arab bi nii après yow donc
waa mën na maa bind waa waa arab rek
léegi dañuy tu moron
laaw
moron man danaa wax waaw
naa 5 bu déedéet ay gone lan ñu nga ne la sinon sànq bi ma leen di may ñu jëndi caaf bi may dund moom bëgguma ñu dund bi may dund ma moom bëgguma samay doon dund moo tax it maa ngi leen jéem ñu dugg ci école pour jàng man xam naa ñun sonn noon ba pare kon suñu doom yi nañ fexe ñoom ñu jàngi pour bañ di ñu dal ñun dal lee ah en tout cas xam nga ñoom man na noo màgg ma bëgg leen bii ñu bëgg dee waaw loolu moo nga ci jaaxal mais ma sañoon moom wax dëgg yàlla ah ñu dugg ci métier moo xamante ni dañuy tikki dara nekk ci loo xam dañuy tikki dara waaw man naa ni moo noon seew ñu doon directeur bi jàngale ji ñu màgg bëgg leneen man ma sañoon ñu mën a doon mécanicien wala ñu mën a tukki di dee ma réalisé dara di li ci kër gi yëpp man ngaa jëm fii ñoom ñu jëmte waaye nag man ma doon seew daal li may dund man ñoom duñ ko dund
si am beneen dundi gudd bi ma
ñëw waaw ci fi ma tollu ni
si mbay mi wa par exemple wa
mbay mi ma bokku ci
wa
ki wu de moy premier tek ci machine bay
ban genre machine
machine ji tek ci machine bay tek ci machine dekk xamni bo ñorale man nga ko del dekk da agit sareb bax na ci
charrette wala tracteur
wala
tracteur bu faté bo mëne lu xus
ah tracteur dama waye fa rek mais tracteur mo no gënal nak wax deug yalla ndax sama soufa ngi ni
nga tolu nga koy dépass
waaw det mom kay tracteur gën mom wax deug yalla mom gënal ni mom day dépass
sa
ko mëno xëc ci mu ñew say mom
ko you know
dina ñi mëna ñëri ñëri
okay well thank you very much chat chat
And when it comes to walking the walk, in addition to creating jobs and wealth here in Mekki, Wade has also had a school breakout inside her house. And you see the difference it makes to kids to have a safe, functional place to learn with lights that work. They've got the same sorts of hopes, dreams, and preoccupations of kids everywhere.
Je m'appelle Mohamed Wal, j'ai 15 ans. J'ai allé à Tuaon et à Pékès jouer des matchs. Mais n'est pas trop grand, c'est une petite ville. Bien parler l'anglais. Parce que j'aime cette pays, le football.
At the end of the day, and this is why it's hard for me to even wrap my mind around the idea of people who don't love people, who don't love humanity. At the end of the day, I love humanity. And it's funny because I don't have children. I will not have children. And it's okay, but it doesn't stop me from loving my fellow humans and those coming after me. And also understanding that the best way to serve God is to take care of his most beloved creation, which I believe is us humans.
J'habite à Angaï. J'ai 6 ans. Je forme en réalité mathématiques.
So, it's one thing for me to work with the parents who are the poor people of today. Thanks to these jobs, they're not poor. But now they can take care of themselves. So that's great. What are we going to do so that the next generation is better off and is better prepared?
I'm going to say. And then you bring the up no quante upper in testing activity. In the best way, you need activity.
You're not listening.
Hi,
you're listening. Ah, so like you don't know what you're doing. You're not going to get it. Never.
Half of our profits are devoted to actually putting back into the school that, you know, I think they saw over there. But that's my choice. That's what the difference, that's what people don't understand. We use capitalism, the free market capitalism, to make money. But then the way we spend our money looks very socialist in this way, you know? We're giving half of it away, you know? People can think redistribution, but it's voluntary. I decided to do it this way.
C'est quoi? Voilà, parce que ici, à part moi, il y a beaucoup de personnes, beaucoup de potos, beaucoup d'étudiants qui ont terminé leur corps, leur étude. Ils n'ont pas de travail pour lequel on est obligé d'aller chercher ailleurs.
For any community to thrive, you have to have two major solid anchors. One is education. Another thing is jobs. If you have jobs and education, you can build a community around it. If you don't have either of those, you can't build a community because people will have to go and take care of that. So that's why it was important for me to have those two components. So jobs are being created through the company, and we needed to create a school. And that school primarily was designed so that the children of our workers could look forward to having better jobs than their parents. And it was very important for me that this school gets created along the lines, be an entrepreneurial school. So where kids learn to think entrepreneurially. Even if they're gonna go work at a company later, I want them to always think entrepreneurially because we know 21st century, the most critical skill is gonna be the skill to think critically and to think independently. If you're not doing that, you're being a robot, a fake one. But the real ones are coming. They're here. So you're not going to be able to compete with them. So we got to prepare kids. And so that's why we wanted to have a school. And it was primarily for the children of our workers. But by now we grew and we have many other kids from around.
Donc, vous pensez que les internet, tu as de cette école est différente. Parce qu'avec votre public, ils sont un peu plus de matière à travailler, à étudier. Or que ici, on nous apprend seulement comment faire sa vie, comment préparer son avenir, c'est-à-dire. On n'a pas de diplôme, mais juste c'est pour montrer à l'individu comment il peut se débrouiller pour son avenir. Il est plus important d'apprendre ces langues, anglais comme français.
We're in a French-speaking nation, that's the official language, yet most of the kids don't speak French because, remember, we're in poor, all the people in these villages, 99.9% of them are poor, very modest backgrounds. Definitely mom, dad didn't go to school themselves. They probably left school when they were 10 or 12, it was a long time ago. Nobody speaks French, nobody. Everybody's speaking the local language. If we were not in a French country, I would not teach them French. But because we're in a French-speaking country, I have to be pragmatic and make sure I prepare them also for their environment. And once they catch the French, then we use that as our bridge language to now teach them English, because that's the ultimate for me. We use the Socratic method because to me, that's the best method in the world to actually teach people to think independently and to think critically.
My name is Hadidjo. I am 15 years old. Je disais que mais si je préfère, c'est quand on fait des séances de discussion socratiques.
Oui, mais quelle est la vérité?
Et ça, c'est le sujet de notre première discussion. Le français est admis à l'école publique, mais je dirais que c'est ici que l'on s'est amélioré. Il y a beaucoup d'idées, mais je n'ai pas encore trouvé l'entrepreneuriat, et ça. J'ai vu ici au Sénégal, le commerce marche le plus. Je voudrais me penser dans ce domaine. Je ne suis pas encore sorti du Sénégal. Je me rends dans les pays de l'Est, au Corée. J'aime bien la culture. J'aime le K-pop aussi.
And by the way, she told us that one of their dilemmas at the school was whether or not to get air conditioning. They didn't want to add to the strain on the frail grid here in Mekki, but in the hot season, it made such a difference to the students that they decided that they just had to. It's one more illustration that Africans need power, not preachiness.
One day I was there and I talked to my husband and I called Michael and I said, Michael, I'm not seeing anything in the kids' eyes. It seems empty. There's nothing behind his eyes. What's going on? And so of course, when I did my little survey, I find that basically primarily they're missing protein. And it makes sense because protein is the most, it's what the brain needs the most, but yet it's the most expensive source. It's the most expensive source of energy, at least in those places. And so right away, we started supplementing the kids in protein with eggs primarily and other things. And we decided to take over their breakfast moment and everything. We told the parents, don't feed them, just send them over here this way. We'll take care of them from there. And I was seeing a major difference. And then eventually though, especially, you know, when it's so hot and everything, which is oftentimes, then you can see the kids are just not, they're just tired. They're just like, and I said, Michael, what do we do? And so Michael's like, I think you really need to get some AC in there. And the guides, because our teachers, we call them guides, like Montessori. The guide saying, Magat, yeah, we think we need some AC. And I agreed. But at the same time, my dilemma was, but what if I get them used to something that I know they're not getting home right now? Because an AC runs on electricity, we're part of a grid, which is not even reliable, but it's super expensive. What, are they not gonna be able to sleep properly at night now? Because at night they're gonna be in the puddle of sweat, like I know they are most of the time. Because sometimes that fan that you have doesn't do anything, it's just moving hot air. But that's what everybody has because it's inexpensive. So I was torn. And we got AC and the kids are just like, I've never seen, I mean, there's just, It's just people think we're raising little geniuses, honestly, especially for those who are out there. Always talking about how, you know, supposedly black people are low IQ, black people are inferior because it's in their genes, whatever. You know, Lee Kuan Yew was famous for saying that access to AC, thanks to affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources, he believes has raised the IQ of Singaporeans by at least 3 points. I would challenge everybody in here, anywhere around the world, to go and try to do math problems and certain things in 100 degrees constantly for hours. You come back and you tell me what you're able to do. So that is another reason why affordable, reliable, abundant energy sources matter. This should not be political. This should not be... just like we need this air to breathe and just to be alive. It's just what energy is. So do you have to be a right wing or a left wing to accept that and to defend it?
We're here in San Luis, the former capital of colonial French West Africa. And apparently, we're in a lot of danger. We've got to stop fussing around and finish the shot before we're engulfed by the rising oceans. Unless that's just tide coming in. But the climate alarmists assure us that it's not, including The Economist, which has a bit of a thing about Senegal and indeed about San Luis. They tell us the Venice of Africa is sinking into the sea. They tell us, drum roll please, that Africa's warming faster than the average. And they also tell us that the seas here are rising faster than the average, which if true would be quite a trick, given that the world's oceans are all connected. But they say they're expected to rise by half a meter in the next 50 years, which would also be quite a trick since the current rate's around 3 millimeters a year. But they say it's going to cause havoc on this continent. 5% of Africans might become climate refugees. And that's an important part of a claim that even though Africa is poor, it should forego the development advantages of fossil fuels because otherwise they'll bring doom down on themselves. Now, even if there were some merit to that argument, surely it would be a lot more compassionate and even efficient for wealthy countries to give up some of the benefits of fossil fuels and let Africans get out of poverty before they start worrying about a fraction of a degree temperature rise. But in any case, the whole thing is nonsense. See that out there? That's the Atlantic Ocean in a rowdy mood, which it's frequently in. And here, San Luis is a place built on low-lying sand. And from time immemorial, that's meant fears of flooding and sometimes real erosion. In places, the seas are washing the shoreline away, as they have been for hundreds, thousands, and even millions of years. But in other places, the shore is accumulating. Rivers are depositing sand, the ocean is depositing sediment. All kinds of natural climate change is going on, and it always has. But I'll tell you what is not happening. That ocean is not coming for me because Africans are starting to burn a bit more natural gas and even, dare I say it, coal.
I talked about bravery at the beginning, and now I want to introduce you to a very brave man, Issa Kouyaté, who runs a refuge for street kids in San Luis.
Bon, ça fait maintenant 15 ans, parce qu'on avait démarré en 2007-2008 à la gare, et après on s'est déplacé pour venir ici en 2010, en avril 2010, et en septembre 2010, il y avait une salle de classe, un bureau et l'infirmerie. Et chaque année, on crée une deuxième salle de classe, quelque chose d'autre. Ensuite, chaque année, on crée, jusqu'à créer le dortoir, la salle de couture, la salle de bibliothèque. Ici, en 2006, mais quand je suis venu, j'ai été un peu choqué par le nombre d'enfants dans les rues et tout ça. Et ça m'a pris du temps de comprendre que bon passe. Quand des enfants d'arriver, qu'on l'exploite. Parce que j'ai demandé, parce que j'habite à Dakar, et là, le quartier où j'habite à Dakar, Il y avait des enfants talibés, mais qui ne sont pas maltraités autant. Mais ici, les enfants, ils passent la longue de journée dans la rue, dans le marché, au quai de pêche, dans le fleuve. Il y a toujours des dangers potentiels. C'est pour cela que je me suis rapproché d'eux et j'ai commencé à discuter avec les enfants, à les suivre, à leur donner à manger, à avoir un sac avec rempli de médicaments, à faire le tour de la ville à vélo. Au début, c'était juste moi, mon vélo et mon sac.
It's an inspiring story, but it's also a depressing tale about how energy poverty in rural Senegal and the resulting lack of schools and jobs sees so many boys sent to the cities to beg, while the girls left behind are pressed into polygamous marriages with men often four times their age. It is a tradition in Senegal for such talibé, or students, to attend Islamic schools or daras and to rely on charity while doing so. But in another classic piece of misdevelopment, the modern-day marabout, or preacher-teacher, has far too often become a 21st-century slave driver.
Et dis pas, parce que je fais encore les choses la nuit, vous allez chercher les enfants qui ont besoin d'aide?
Exactement. Souvent, ces tours de la nuit, on le prend le mardi et le jeudi. Mais les enfants ont commencé à comprendre que chaque mardi, nous, on doit sortir. Et ils ne veulent pas être attrapés. Donc, ils changent de place. Et c'est pour cela que par moment, on change le mardi en mercredi. Et le jeudi, on le change en samedi. Ou on le change en lundi. Parce qu'on ne les force pas à les prendre. On les invite à venir. Mais ce sont eux qui sont partis jusqu'à ne plus vouloir être dans le dar, ni aller chez eux, dans leur famille. Ils veulent rester dans la rue. Faire des petits larcins, aller dans le marché, voler des petits trucs, tout ça. Et c'est pour cela qu'il y a beaucoup d'enfants très gentiment emblimés. Et ces rendez-vous de nuit-là, nous le faisons le mardi et le jeudi. De minuit jusqu'à 1h, 2h le matin, pour faire des rondes dans la ville de Saint-Louis. Et quand on trouve les enfants talibés, on les amène ici pour qu'ils viennent dormir ici. Donc ici, nous avons par exemple un registre qui permet de voir qu'il y a beaucoup d'enfants que nous prenons par exemple. Tout ça, ce sont des enfants de la rue. Avec ce système, nous sommes à, si je vois bien, nous sommes à plus de 1000 enfants recueillis dans le dortoir ici. Donc, si on fait le cumul, en 2024, nous avons fait 2061 enfants, fin 2024. De 2023 jusqu'à 2025, nous sommes à 2023 enfants.
Ok, est-ce que vous avez les mêmes enfants temps après temps, ou est-ce que c'est presque toujours les gens différents?
C'est toujours les gens différents. Mais quand il y a des enfants qui viennent ici, une fois, deux fois, on le met en rouge dans l'ordinateur. Si on rencontre un enfant dans la rue une troisième fois, on ne le rend plus dans le dara. On le ramène dans sa famille. Et sa famille pourrait le ramener dans une autre ville, tel que Dakar ou bien Touba ou quelque part autre. Mais s'il vient ici à Saint-Louis, il a des problèmes avec la loi. Donc tout enfant qui est en danger, le plus souvent, nous allons directement contacter l'AEMO. C'est l'action éducative en milieu ouvert et c'est le ministère de la Justice pour les enfants. Donc cette personne-là va recevoir une notification et cette notification lui permet de dire que cet enfant-là, si on le retrouve encore à Saint-Louis, même s'il est dans un autre dara bien caché, si Maison de la Gare nous signale que cet enfant est là, c'est le marabout qui sera pris et amené en prison. C'est-à-dire, on discute aussi avec une collaboration directe avec les maîtres coraniques. On discute avec eux, on les sensibilise, on leur propose à être vraiment humbles, à suivre l'enfant de sorte à l'éduquer, à le sécuriser, mais aussi à être complémentaire sur l'enfant. Parce que s'il n'y a pas de suivi et d'éducation, l'enfant ne peut pas aller loin. Il y a des beaux marabouts qui sont là, qui enseignent bien et qui pratiquent vraiment la religion, l'apprentissage coranique. Après l'enfant, il finit, il rentre. Mais il y a d'autres marabouts qui prennent les enfants pour des travailleurs, des jeunes travailleurs. Il y a des enfants qui sont dans la rue pour chercher les coubelles des canettes, de la ferraille. Il y a des enfants qui travaillent dans des maisons comme des bonnes. Et que ce n'est pas la famille qui les paye directement, mais la famille paye le maître coranique. Il y a d'autres enfants qui sont juste dans la rue pour trouver de l'argent et amener pour le marabout. Et ces enfants-là varient entre 4 ans, 5 ans, jusqu'à 12 ans, 15 ans. Ça dépend de l'âge de l'enfant pour qu'on te donne un quota d'argent que tu dois donner, soumettre au marabout. Une grande agence des Nations Unies, ils ont fait un recensement de combien ils reçoivent en moyenne l'année. Ces marabouts-là reçoivent 5 milliards de francs.
Chaque année.
Sur la mendicité. Juste sur la mendicité des enfants. Donc imaginez que dans Saint-Louis, il y a 22 000 enfants talibés et presque les 11 000, la moitié de ces enfants sont des enfants mendiants et que ces enfants mendiants-là qui donnent chaque jour 350. Et si tu fais le calcul en l'espace d'une année, tu te retrouves millionnaire. Et ces marabouts, c'est pour cela qu'ils ne veulent pas lâcher la mendicité forcée. Donc nous, on est là pour bloquer la mendicité forcée. On est là pour vraiment dire que cette forme d'apprentissage coranique n'est pas dans la religion. N'est pas du tout. C'est pas conforme que de faire travailler un enfant. C'est pas du tout conforme que de dire à un enfant d'aller dans la rue, de ne pas sauter sur son éducation, sur sa santé, sur son bien-être social et d'entretenir un enfant sur une maison abandonnée ou bien dans juste une baraque quelque part où l'enfant ne va pas dormir trop bien. La maison n'a pas d'électricité, n'a pas d'eau, il n'y a pas de porte, souvent même il n'y a pas de toit. Quand la pluie va venir, ces enfants vont avoir de sérieux problèmes.
So Kouyaté is out there night after night looking for these kids, and he's in here day after day building this refuge, including a school where they crowd in to learn.
30, 40, ça dépend des jours. Parce que le jeudi et le vendredi, c'est le week-end à eux. Donc, ils passent ici. L'affluence, c'est le jeudi et le vendredi.
Vous êtes 30 ou 40?
30, 40.
Dans cette salle?
Dans cette salle.
OK.
Oui. Et des fois, même plus.
De quel âge?
De 5, 6 ans jusqu'à 12 ans.
OK. Et elle enseigne toutes les classes?
Elle enseigne toutes les classes. Donc voilà.
Okay.
Par exemple, ici, il y a... On prend les jeunes qui viennent, tous ceux qui apprennent. À ce jour-là, il y avait 33 enfants qui sont venus. Vous voyez. Donc, chaque jour, ça pourrait changer. Et leur âge aussi. Là, c'est 6 ans, 7 ans, 12 ans, 13 ans, 15 ans. Il y en a même qui ont 15 ans et qui ne savent pas lire. Et il y en a à côté qui ont 7 ans qui savent lire. Et c'est pour ça qu'on les mixe tous dans la même salle de classe. Et les plus grands sont aidés par les plus petits. Le plus souvent. C'est comme ça que ça se passe. Quand ils viennent ici, ils n'ont que le Coran dans leur tête. Et souvent même, le Coran, ils sont trop lents. Parce que c'est la rue qui les formate. C'est-à-dire, ils sont plus dans la rue que dans le Dara. Donc c'est pour cela que nous avons ouvert le centre. Pour leur permettre de ne pas trop aller dans la rue parce qu'il y a le danger. Je dis que le plus souvent, les enfants, quand ils viennent ici le matin, c'est très rare s'ils viennent le soir. Mais parce que le matin, ils vont dans les maisons pour trouver de l'argent, de la nourriture, du riz pour le versement. Et quand ils trouvent le versement, ils vont aller le donner chez le marabout. Et l'après-midi, ils peuvent passer ici. Mais tant qu'ils ne trouvent pas le versement, ils seront battus et emprisonnés. Toutes ces personnes-là nous aident. Elles nous aident sur l'éducation des enfants. Il y a aussi une autre dame qui est de l'autre côté, dans l'autre salle de classe, qui nous aide. On a des stats de 17 personnes, chacun SVDD. Et ça leur permet aussi d'être joyeux, ça leur permet aussi de de vraiment venir parce que souvent aussi on les change, les habits. Et quand ils sont malades aussi, le marabout, il ne fait absolument rien sur cette maladie. Il y a beaucoup d'infections qu'ils ont et nous, c'est nous-mêmes qui les soignons ici, le plus souvent. Peut-être le marabout, il agit sur l'éducation coranique, mais nous agissons sur l'éducation coranique, sur la santé, sur la sécurité de l'enfant et sur son hygiène buccale, bucco-dentaire, sur ses yeux, sur tout. Parce que tout ce que nous faisons une prise en charge. Si on ne peut absolument pas faire rien avec l'infirmerie, on l'amène à l'hôpital. Le marabout, chaque fois on leur demande que l'enfant doit aller à l'hôpital, ils disent qu'ils n'ont pas d'aveu.
A twist to the story that's dear to my heart is that among the things the kids find here is a karate program, sponsored in part by a dojo in Ottawa, where they put on gis, train, and perform on sand without walls or roof, and yet learn discipline and also hope.
Ici, mais dans le centre, pour au moins démontrer que le karaté est venu et nous l'avons adopté, les enfants veulent vraiment plus que le sable, professionnaliser le karaté pour avoir comme maison de la gare et son propre équipe de karaté et participer au tournoi de la Shoei.
Then I asked him what people can do to help.
Vous savez, le plus souvent, les mots, l'image valeur, plus que les mots, ce que vous êtes en train de faire là est beaucoup plus important que de parler ou d'aider. Parce que le plus souvent, donner, il faut faire le partage de ce qu'on a appris.
Parce qu'il y a beaucoup qui viennent ici et qui disent que mais j'ai jamais vu ça. Je comprends pas.
Parce que quand vous voyez des enfants manger dans la rue, très petits, en danger parce qu'ils ne portent pas de chaussures, ils sont sales, ils ont des crasses, ils sont restés 3, 4, 5 jours sans se doucher. Il faut le montrer. Parce que les gens, ce qu'ils doivent voir, c'est l'image réelle de ce qui se passe. S'ils voient l'image, là, on aura l'impression qu'il y a quelque chose qui se passe, qui n'est pas juste bien. Et comment faire pour le changer?
Issa Kouyaté and his associates are heroes for helping these kids. But wouldn't it be even better to provide power so there can be schools and meaningful work back home in the villages? Wouldn't that be better for these boys forced to beg in the streets and for the girls who are left behind? Now, let's be clear. Not all of Africa's problems come from outside, including those of governance. Indeed, one of the major defects of the post-colonial mindset is this tendency to shrug off all blame, which works as badly for nations or cultures as it does for individuals. Including shrugging off blame for the rapid descent of Ghana, that's the first sub-Saharan country to gain full independence, and it went from parliamentary democracy to president-for-life dictatorship and compulsory indoctrination of all college students at the Kwame Nkrumah Ideological Institute in just 7 years. And I should note also that there is nothing indigenous about that kind of an institution. And what about the bone-through-the-nose antics of Idi Amin, or the Rwandan genocide, or making the mad tyrant Robert Mugabe chair of the African Union in 2015, or the current mess in South Africa? A lot of this stuff is self-inflicted, including corruption. And here in Senegal, it is a democracy, though a fragile one, but like much of the continent, it has a government and a political culture that is meddlesome and, yes, corrupt. Including busybodies continually telling us that we couldn't film somewhere and apparently hoping for a payment. In fact, we had to bribe the same guy twice just to film at the Monument de la Renaissance Africaine, whereas an honest guy stays bought.
So what did that guy tell you, no filming or?
Yeah.
Why build it, then don't let people film it?
And that kind of thing is something only Africans can fix, and it's something they do need to fix because it's holding them back and it's not somebody else's fault.
So we're here in what I think is a fairly upscale part of Dakar. At any event, we're here to pick up our studio gear. And there are some nice houses here, though they're clearly gated and well protected, and there are some nice cars here. But at the same time, you see a great deal of public squalor. And this thing behind me is a public renovation. It's meant to be fixing up parks and public spaces. But even the sign admits that it's 6 months behind, and the sign itself is kind of dusty. I think it would be a brave or foolish person who would bet any money they liked on this thing being completed 6 months after the due date, or indeed, ever. Was it hard to get the business license and get through all the other kinds of paperwork so that you could actually set up and start employing people here?
The funny thing is that people are going to be always boasting and say, oh, you know, and I see it on online even when you post about it. They say, it can take 6 months, a year, sometimes longer. And people are like, oh, but that's not true. We have a 24-hour, one-stop shop. You know, so all over Africa, they have these one-stop shops. All of these governments, because once they heard about these problems, they say, okay, we're gonna make it easy. We're gonna have a one-stop shop. Because it's so hard to go from this desk to that desk, you have to go to the tax office, you have to go to the, employment office, you have to go to the this license permit office, you have to go to that office. It's 20 million places you have to go to. And then the grand idea is, we're gonna put them all in one place. So you just go from window to window to window, and voila, 24-hour service. The devil is in the details. It takes 24 hours, supposedly, but after you have all the little papers that you need to put in your file, then once you have that file complete, then yeah, it takes some 24 hours to process it. But some of these items, you need a birth certificate. Some people, they don't know where the birth certificates are because most of the time, nothing is digitized. So sometimes also your parents did not really declare you when you were born. So we don't know, you don't have a birth certificate. So at that point, maybe you're supposed to go and find a judge, and the judge is supposed to run a judgment saying, okay, I judge that you are this person or whatever. Some others, it's like you have to get a bank account, but to get the bank account, you also need that, birth certificates and who knows whatever else. To get that bank account, you need to go to your, like in a neighborhood like this, you go not necessarily to a mayor, but you go to the chief of your neighborhood for him or her to write a character letter on your behalf. And then that allows you to bring all of those pieces of paperwork, put them in the file. And that is a thing that goes and takes 24 hours to file. But you see, they don't talk like that and they don't explain that. And so the problem you have is most people are in the informal sector. In this country, it's 95, sometimes more than 95% of all the businesses that are in the informal sector.
We're now in downtown Dakar. This was the old French Quarter, of course, in the that old days, that meant whites only. It has since become the heart of the government of Senegal. I mean, this is where you're going to find the presidential palace. This is where you're going to find the parliament. The old courthouse is behind me. All of this very nice part of the town looks very much like a successful and prosperous country. But there's an aspect of this that is easy to overlook that's critical to the story here, including to the story of how Senegal can properly develop its energy resources by fending off Western do-gooders. Ever since the Second World War, there's been a lot of concern about poverty in what came to be known as the Third World, and a process that was called modernization. When I was at the University of Texas, I studied under Walt Rostow, who was Lyndon Johnson's national security advisor during the Vietnam War, but he was also for a long time the best-selling economist in the history of the world. And that's because of his book, The Stages of Economic Growth. And in that book, Rostow said that essentially all societies pass through the same stages, and it's just a matter of when and what kind of bumps they hit along the way. You have a traditional society, and then you get these preconditions for dynamic economic growth, and then you get the takeoff into dynamic economic growth, and that's followed by the drive for technological maturity and then high mass consumption. And the idea was that this was a kind of natural process, and if you just removed a few obstacles, one of which clearly was classical European colonialism, it would happen naturally. But the results of this idea were actually quite disappointing in a lot of parts of the world. And one of the reasons they were disappointing is that a lot of countries, when they achieved independence from the European colonial powers, believed the Soviets, who told them, look, there's a better way of doing this. There's a faster way. There's a less disruptive way. Don't be like the old colonial masters. Don't go with free enterprise and individualism. We industrialized in the space of one generation. We did what it took European countries 60, 70, or 80 years to do. And when we did that, we caught up with them militarily as well. We got our pride back, and you can do that too. You can wipe out the humiliations of colonialism through central planning and big government.
And this was a terrible blind alley that far too much of Africa went down. But there's another blind alley as well. And that's that this idea that modernization was a universal process wasn't quite right. What people were talking about in large measure was westernization. That is to say that countries had to adopt the kind of cultural habits that were prevalent in the West if they were going to develop the military power that would enable them to fend off neocolonialism, if they were going to develop the economic power that would sustain that military power, and if they were going to give their people prosperity and a good life, this fabled high mass consumption. And the funny thing is that it was critics on the left primarily who saw that there was a problem here. Theodor von Laue, who actually interestingly started out studying Russia, and he said Russia's the first underdeveloped country, the first one to face this dilemma, how to fend off the West with Western methods without actually becoming Western. Because if in order to manage Western armies, you need the Western economy, and if in order to have a Western economy, you need Western culture, then the whole project of defeating Western armies so you wouldn't have Western culture imposed on you is a lost battle before it starts. So there's a tragic dilemma here. In his Magisterial History of the Middle East, written about 25 years ago, Bernard Lewis asks readers to imagine the cadence of a cafe somewhere in the Middle East, and they're playing a board game or dominoes, drinking tea or coffee, you know, smoking cigarettes, maybe they're reading a newspaper, and they've got half an ear on pop music coming out of the radio, or they've got half an eye on TV. And he says, they look a lot like pages of a cafe somewhere in Europe, but look a lot different than their ancestors did 200 years ago. And of course, so do the people in the European cafe. But Lewis says there's a critical difference here, and that is that all the changes over the past 200 years in the European cafe have come from inside European society. In the Middle East, all the changes come from outside. I mean, everything from radios and pop music to newspapers, and in all likelihood, the plumbing that would have been installed by a European colonial power. And of course, 25 years later, it's fast food joints and cell phones and earbuds. The pace of change is going faster. But it remains a fact, and in fact, in some ways it's gotten worse, that if those of us in the West are riding a tiger with modernization, much of the rest of the world is clinging to the tail and being dragged along. And if that seems a bit odd or even cosmic, there's a line that I've dimly remembered. I thought it was from Frantz Fanon or somebody, but I looked it up, there's a reason to do that. And it turns out it's from Salman Rushdie in The Jaguar's Smile, where he says, all of us who are not from the mighty West or North have something in common as a perspective. He says, nothing so simple as a unified third world view, but we all understand that feeling of weakness, of being underneath, in his memorable phrase of looking up at the descending heel. And it's extremely important to understand that however unsettling modernization is, when it is coming organically from inside your own society, it's a lot more disruptive when it's coming down on you. And you see this now with people who are looking for development in Africa and who are saying, you know, we want to be like the rest of the world, but we also want to be true to ourselves. And there's a lot of emphasis on national pride and national identity. And this brings me again to this whole question of development, and particularly the insistence of Western governments and international financing agencies, which are essentially tools of Western governments, that African development has to follow what is now trendy in Western circles, that it must be green, it must be wind and solar, that once again, Africans must do what enlightened Westerners tell them they should do, and they must adopt the Western model. And none of that's to say that it wouldn't be a good idea to have clean energy, but it is to say that in trying to impose a development model from above, even with the best of intentions, you can very often find yourself ensuring that what you get is misdevelopment. And that, if you wish the people of this continent well and poor people throughout the world, is something you must try to avoid. And in order to do that, you're going to have to swallow your pride. And here, when you see the gleaming buildings in the downtown, things like the Museum of Black Africa, there's actually a connection between that state opulence and the private squalor that you see in so many places. Because when you look at all these people in the informal economy, you seem to be selling secondhand TV remotes, and secondhand fans, and even it looks like secondhand shoes. And you're wondering, how could this possibly be sustained? But the answer, to a surprising degree, is because all this money is flooding into the country from the development agencies and the do-gooders. And that is enabling the Senegalese, their government, and the people to import things.
When you arrive in any country, there's going to be an international airport. It's probably named for a dead politician. There's going to be a flag. There's going to be a national anthem. There's going to be a presidential palace. There's going to be a national slogan. And here in Senegal, the slogan is Ben Askan, Ben Mabed, Ben Began. And that means one people, one goal, one faith. And, you know, I would be a little bit sarcastic about that because, of course, in many former colonies, the European powers drew artificial borders and there may not be a strong sense of national identity. As for one goal, at the same time, sort of grandiose and vague and possibly a bit collectivist. And then one faith is an interesting thing to have here in Senegal because the country is overwhelmingly Muslim, but they're very relaxed and there's a lot of religious freedom and diversity. But of course, I shouldn't be too snide since their national anthem is the Red Lion, whereas ours is, Oh Canada. Oh, that's original. And then when you go into their capital, mostly other cities, you know, you see things like ministries and you see stadiums and you see theaters and you see museums dedicated to the local history. You think, okay, this looks like it's going pretty well. I mean, the museum's going to give people pride in their culture and traditions, and that will help them complete the job of modernization. But the fact of the matter is that things, including these stadiums, have given me the cold robies for decades. I read a book in the 1980s. It was called L'Afrique étranglée by René Dumont and Marie-France Martin. And it was a very left-wing look at development, but it made a point that has stayed with me and even haunted me. And that is that when third world countries try to create the facade of successful modernization by wringing more out of the people than they could possibly afford to pay in order to put on these grandiose displays out in the hinterland, people are owing sand by hand. And that's a contrast that really ought to be very worrying. And Dumont told a revealing story about the time that Zambia was hosting a meeting of the Commonwealth in 1979, and they're putting on the grand display with the canapes and the diplomats and all this hoo-ha. And he said to them, why don't you do something more modest, more authentically indigenous, and something more in keeping with the actual level of economic development? And he asked one of the ministers, why don't you do this more generally for development? And the guy told him, seriously, he said, if we do that, how can we build the Champs-Élysées in Lusaka? You know, I'm all for there being a Champs-Élysées in Lusaka or in Dakar or anywhere. But as Dumont and Martin insisted, if it's going to happen, it's got to arise spontaneously from a populace that is becoming wealthy enough to afford these things. It's got to be an authentic reflection of the way that things are going well in the country. It must not be something that is wrung out of a populace that can't afford it but can't stop it. And too often, that's exactly what you're seeing. A Potemkin facade that isn't just not modernization, it's actually antithetical to modernization. And here I want to mention again the British Industrial Revolution, which is meant to be the model. But of course, that thing arose from below. That wasn't because of a government plan, a five-year plan. If anything, it was the Blaxton Plan. There's a line that I quote to illustrate about the Anglosphere, this system based on secure individual rights coming out of Magna Carta. And as a commentator, he called his nation a land, perhaps the only one in the universe, in which political or civil liberty is the very end and scope of the Constitution, end quote. Couldn't be a more American sentiment, right? But it's actually William Blaxton writing in 1765 and talking about the United Kingdom. And if development comes up from the people with secure property rights, building businesses the state can't take away from them, then eventually you're going to get a very impressive display in your cities, but it's going to be one that reflects what's really happening. If it's forced from above, it isn't just not happening, it's prevented from happening. Of course, there are people productively employed here, as we understand that term, from those working in construction to the people fishing out of Saint Louis. But too many of them are not, with consequences as strange as they are pernicious. And something we noticed here that we were not expecting. You come here with some idea what we're likely to find and what it likely means, but we also have our eyes and our minds open. And one of the things that's extraordinary here, in fact, is the amount of trash that you see. And very little of this stuff was made here. Indeed, as we've been traveling around Senegal, something that started as a surprise developed into an obsession for me. And it's the question of these used tires. This seems to be the used tire capital of the world. It's part of the trash problem more generally.
In some ways, much of Senegal is actually a garbage dump. There's an incredible amount of waste plastic here. It's everywhere that we've been, and I think almost none of it was made here. And as for those tires, again, they're everywhere. People use them as flower planters, they half bury them on dirt roads to help keep cars from crashing into their homes, they use them to line soccer fields. But there are also stacks of them, and scattered individual tires or parts of tires by the sides of streets and in fields. They are ubiquitous. And I think we'd know a lot more about the country, its economy, and its political culture, as well as its ecology, if we knew where they came from. We actually asked one local, but he'd never thought about it. In fact, amazingly, he'd never noticed them. Are they shipped here new, in packages, or on vehicles? Sold, and gradually become waste? Do they arrive in consignments of used tires, possibly as recycling? Do they come in used on cars? Who sells them? Who buys them? And why, when there are already so many? It's one more strange aspect of misdevelopment. And here again, I got to thinking about Britain and the Industrial Revolution.
Because, of course, the Industrial Revolution in England, though it brought a sustained and dramatic improvement in living standards, also created a kind of grimy poverty on an industrial scale and a lot of pollution. Those supposedly romantic pea soup fogs in the Sherlock Holmes stories were actually very dangerous. They killed people, they caused enormous respiratory problems, and they weren't really fixed until the 1950s. But one thing about all that, both the prosperity and the pollution, is it was domestically generated and then it was domestically dealt with. But the things that you see here seem to have washed up from all around the world. And that's another example of this critical problem of misdevelopment. And misdevelopment is caused in large measure by well-meaning Westerners doing the wrong thing and doing it on a grand scale.
It may be different further east or south in parts of the country that we weren't able to visit. But whatever's going on inland, in every place we did get to, there was plastic trash everywhere. And I don't know how on earth they're ever going to clean it all up. But I'll tell you one thing that's a key part of our story. They're not going to clean it up by staying poor.
It's a hazy day here in San Luis. And so, fittingly, there's something you can't see out there, but you might be able to one day. And that's natural gas rings that can bring this country affordable, dependable energy with which it can get out of poverty and achieve prosperity. And you may notice one of the things that Senegal was trying to do is develop a tourist industry. And it's a beautiful place, and tourism is widely admired as a clean industry, except perhaps for all jet travel with the dreaded carbon. But one of the things they're going to have to do if they really want to make that succeed is clean the place up a bit. And poor people can't afford to take care of the environment. It's another way in which development, once it gets going, becomes self-sustaining and self-reinforcing. And it's one of the ways in which denying these people the ability to make their economy start to work is being so cruel to them, so bad for the environment, and so immoral.
We're here at the Banja Nature Reserve to see some of the magnificent creatures for which Africa is so justly famous. And it's obvious that part of the plan for sustainable prosperity in Senegal is ecotourism. But of course, as so often, there's a perilous interaction here between poverty and development. If they get it right, then they preserve the habitat, they prosper, they clean up the country, and they can protect these animals and the places they live so that the big and the small can flourish.
Yes, the horns, we reduce it to protect them from the poacher. Poacher can shoot them. They kill the animals for these horns. They sell it in Aziz, very expensive.
But if they get it wrong, then you get a spiral downward as people encroach on the habitat and kill the animals or drive them off. I mean, people who need firewood for breakfast tomorrow can't think about the state of the environment 10 years from now. And people who are hungry are going to go and get themselves some bush meat. And if you show up later and say, excuse me, don't you realize that the eland is endangered? They're going to tell you, excuse me, don't you realize my kids are endangered?
And another thing. At one point I was talking to Magat Wade about Western environmentalists, and she commented sourly
that a lot of them seem to care more about the chimpanzees in Africa than they did about the people. And, you know, there aren't any chimpanzees here in Senegal. There are adorable little monkeys who will absolutely steal your hat, your camera, and your food if you relax your vigilance. You know, I'm all for chips, but people come first for me. Fortunately, you really don't have to make a choice, because there's a kind of rule of thumb. When countries start to develop, at first, there is a more and more environmental damage.
They're exploiting the resources and getting food on the table and not worrying either about pollution or about habitat loss. But then at a certain point, and it was around $5,000 per capita GDP, at least back in the 1990s, the curve of rising prosperity and rising environmental harm does a U-turn, because they reach a point where they can afford to care about the environment and they can afford to do something about it. So, it's crucial not to try to impose policies on Senegal and other countries like it that will derail or deform development, because it's critically important to protect this habitat now while it's still here. You can't go back later, say oops, and get it back.
And just like that, we're nearly at the end of our time in Senegal. And as usual, it feels like we've been here for ages and that we just got here. We've seen a lot of things that we were rather expecting to see, and we've had surprises that we will never forget.
We've received a very warm welcome, and we've tried to be good guests.
And as we wrap up, the most important thing about this trip and everything that we've seen and heard is that these interrelated problems of poverty and of economic development and of energy are not an academic exercise. Well, if you get it wrong, you might get a C on a term paper. These are real people with real and complicated lives, often lived under conditions of almost unimaginable hardship. So, if you want to do good for poor people in the world, especially if you want to do it with tax money that you got from somebody else, you better understand the implications of your actions. Because these people can have a brighter future, and they should have.